What's up, my niggas? It's another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig. Somewhere over there is Scott.
Hiya.
And somewhere slightly over the other way is Drew.
Hello.
We're going to talk about films.
Crack on. So, Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy as a hilariously mismatched cop duo. I can't wait, Scott.
Well, you've basically succinctly put the entire plot of The Heat together. I had some hope for The Heat coming into it because it's directed by Paul Feig and it stars Melissa McCarthy, who, of course, in combination, would be presumably part of the great success between Bridesmaids, which a film that I found pretty damn funny and enjoyed heartily. However, on the other hand, this is a comedy that stars Sandra Bullock, which is something of an anchor.
What's the densest element that we know of?
You know, I forget how they do it, but these, you know, pentel quadium, something like that.
It's an anchor made of that.
Yeah, it's a heavy, heavy anchor.
Yeah, Scott, though, it's a comedy that stars Sandra Bullock. It's not, however, a comedy that stars both Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds. So I think
that's true.
It could be worse.
It's a comedy starring Sandra Bullock. What a mutually exclusive phrase that is. I don't even think that's correct either, but never mind. Sorry, for the benefit of everyone's sanity, let's carry on.
So the story behind The Heat is you have Agent Ashburn, played by Sandra Bullock, who's an amazingly ambitious FBI agent who's also not the most well-liked member of her team. She's somewhat abrasive and somewhat overconfident in her own abilities and quite happily rubs it in the face of others and generally not particularly pleasant person. She's angling for promotion. She's somewhat guaranteed this promotion if she can track down and bring to justice an elusive drug lord, Mr. Larkin, who's never been seen by the FBI. They have no idea who he is, so on and so forth. The best they've come up with is there's possibly some connection to Boston, and so she is dispatched to the Boston field office. As part of this, she stumbles across the part of Detective Mullins, played by Melissa McCarthy, who is a take-no-prisoners, have-no-social-graces, loud, somewhat obnoxious, shouty officer. And it's a sort of, Ashburn being the more straight-laced character obviously comes into some kind of clash with them, and thus comedy is supposed to ensue. And it kind of does, as they reluctantly join forces in the same way as many buddy cop movies have done throughout the years. The main difference, of course, being this was a buddy cop movie where both the cops are female, which is not something you would normally get in this kind of things. This is not Lethal Weapon. It is something of a somewhat different ilk, but it's the same basic setup, but it's played rather more for laughs.
Can I say what a blow it is for feminist cinema that Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy have picked up this genre a mere quarter of a century after it fell out of popularity?
Yeah, it does seem somewhat behind the times. It does feel an awful lot like it's out of temporal displacement kind of thing.
It's been out of fashion so long that it's already come back into fashion and back out again.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that is now being ruthlessly parodied in things like The Other Guys and such. Like,
ruthlessly parodied by parodies of parodies.
Yes, it's now beyond redemption.
Cutting edge cinema.
Of course, it is not taking itself remotely seriously. It is certainly far more on the comedy side of the equation rather than a drama. And you know what? It's certainly not bad. I enjoyed it reasonably well. It is sitting with a user rating at the minute on IMDb of about 7, which is fair. Of the reviews that I read, it was deemed to be pretty damn good. And when I went into it, I came out thinking, well, that's good, but it's certainly not pretty damn. It is probably doing as well as you can expect, given that you have Sandra Bullock in it, who I have no regard for.
She's an unobtainium anchor.
She just isn't likeable, and her comedy delivery's not brilliant.
But she's the best actress ever!
I'm sure we've spoken of this before. It just seems like there's something of a dearth of opportunity given to female actors, to the point where you wind up with having to draw on the same small pool of people all the time for pretty much every role you can think of. And I just feel there's got to be many female actresses desperate for a break that are much better than Sandra Bullock at this sort of role.
There's such a dearth of material for female actors that when it does come along, they end up rehashing Eddie Murphy films from 30 years ago.
Yeah. Another 48 hours. You know, the film itself, you know, it's pretty entertaining. I'm not going to get into the plot or anything like that because it doesn't really matter. It's pretty funny. Basically, it's entirely carried by Melissa McCarthy, the same way that Identity Thief, who has the personality to kind of drag this along. The supporting actresses and actors and so forth are perfectly adequate. It bangs along at a good old pace. You're not really left waiting for the next reasonably funny scene to come along, so I have no particular complaints with it. I did enjoy it quite a lot, and I laughed a reasonable amount. Certainly not the funniest film I've seen in the last few months, but it's up there. More than worthy of your time and attention, especially if you like Melissa McCarthy and something like the Bridesmaids film.
If you like Melissa McCarthy in something other than a coffin.
I'm not sure what you're getting at there. It seems awfully harsh.
To be fair, it is harsh. I just can't take her. Sorry.
I would advise that if you do not like Melissa McCarthy, and let's face it, no one likes Sandra Bullock, then you're not going to like this film in that case. Especially given it's got Marlon Wayans in a supporting role, which is a bit of an anchor as well.
Wayans is always a name to be wary of.
Yes. I suppose that's to its credit. For all the anchors dragging this down, I still laughed quite a lot and found it reasonably funny.
Do you know what? In this day and age, yeah, that sort of qualifies it as probably being worth a look.
Isn't that a depressing thought?
Can I just say that obviously I realise a huge amount of time has elapsed since our last podcast, but I realise that in my head, the film I've directed called Indemnity Teeth is way better than Pacific Rim. Oh no, I demand recompense for a heinous crime that has been laid upon my doorstep. Here. Have these teeth.
Some sort of vigilante dentist film.
Yes. Right, Monsters University. A prequel to Monsters, Inc. What more is there to say? Drew has more to say. Don't you, Drew?
I do, Craig. I do.
Excellent. Say it? Fulfill your destiny, sir. For these next 5 minutes are the very reason you were born.
And thus it was written. And thus it shall come to pass.
Feel the weight of destiny upon thy shoulders, Drew. No pressure.
I have broad shoulders. I can take the burden.
Oh, okay.
Manly shoulders. Alas that Pixar, and even before they were fully consumed by the Mouse House, were following the trend of pretty much the rest of Hollywood and cashing in on their IP of sequels. Their brilliance of Toy Story 2 and 3 would perhaps vindicate that plan, however, though the less said about Cars 2, the better. But their first attempt at a prequel fares far less well. Set an indeterminate number of years before Monsters Incorporated, Monsters University tells the tale of a young Mike Wazowski, who sets his heart on becoming a scarer after a school field trip to Monsters, Inc., and his subsequent educational career in the scare program at Monsters University, where he meets his best friend to be James Sullivan and nemesis to be Randall Boggs, all of whom are voiced by the same actors as Monsters, Inc. In the beginning, Mike is the enthusiastic academic studying hard with his friend and roommate Randall, while Sully is the talented but lazy son of a legendary scarer who thinks he can coast by on charm, raw ability and his family name. At the end of the first semester, Sully and Mike are cut from the programme by Helen Mirren's Dean Hardscrabble and they must work together to prove themselves worthy of readmittance. Now, that part of the plot, well, most of the plot, is entirely unremarkable, but the building friendship and respect between the heroes is enjoyable enough and there are plenty of nods to the 2001 film for fans. An explanation of why the abominable snowman was banished, for example. And there are a decent number of laughs and fun sequences for newcomers to enjoy. What Monsters University is not, alas, is in any way special. It feels tired and forced, and it seems Pixar has finally caught up with the rest of Hollywood in being far better off creating something new rather than warming over old properties. My biggest beef with this, though, is a pet hate of mine. Fraternities, and in this film also sororities. This film is absolutely blighted by their inclusion. Their juvenile pranks, exclusionary practices, and all the other tiresome baggage that comes with this peculiarly American institution form a bulk of the narrative drive, and it's so awdry and depressing. And this is a family film, so the fraternities as depicted here are not quite as egregious as they so often are, but it's a real problem, as is the way the film skates dangerously close to bullying from the main characters. Not a positive message for kids, I'd have thought. And all that said, I still enjoyed it, as did my 4-year-old niece who took it to see it. Just don't expect Pixar magic.
Yeah, don't expect that shit.
I've not seen the film, but fraternities annoy me.
Fraternities annoy the crap out of me.
I've only just worked it out. I think it's because the drinking age in most American states is probably 21.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're probably going to university at 20, you know, 18, 19, something like that.
18, yeah.
It's just a way to get a drink, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The older people buy it for you. We don't need that in this country. That's why we just go and get drunk. And
that's why we get out of our system much earlier.
Our fraternity is a pub.
Juvenile, though, and they're hateful things.
Mm. Yeah. They're active vessels of the promotion of social exclusion, essentially,
yes,
which
exactly.
goes against everything that university should actually be. bestowing upon you. So
it certainly goes against everything I stand for. So. Yeah. But yeah, we've talked on the podcast before about how alien American high school seemed to us.
Mm.
And I think possibly fraternities are even more alien. I don't think there's anywhere in Britain that has a university that does stuff like that.
On which note, we should probably start our own fraternity.
Hell yeah.
Yes, let's not. Yeah, it's any time a film brings in fraternities, even stuff where films otherwise enjoyable, like Old School, the whole fraternity thing, it's just so tiresome. It puts me off a film right away when since they're brought in.
Toga, toga, toga.
Toga.
It's okay and kids are going to enjoy it, but it's so very far away from Pixar's best stuff, which disappoints me.
Kind of going downhill quickly, aren't they?
They do feel that way.
No way, planes will rescue them.
Which isn't Pixar, it's Disney, but it's just like Cars, so it's the same thing.
Oh, is it not Pixar? Ah, okay.
It's not been released as Pixar, but given it looks identical to Cars but with planes, then I'm not sure how most people are going to be able to tell the difference.
Yes, I assume most people will fall into the same perception trap as I just have. Our on-demand catch-up feature of this podcast is Jack Reacher, in which Tom Cruise upsets a lot of author Lee Child's fanboys by portraying a character who is clearly a foot taller than the actor, therefore predisposing the film to failure, apparently. Scott, is this film a failure on the basis of its star's height?
Does he look tall on the page or something?
The question is, does Tom Cruise act tall, Scott?
Does he walk tall? Does he act tall? Honestly, it was not high up on my list of concerns, or indeed on that list of concerns whatsoever. So this is based on the popular series of novels from Lee Child, as you so adroitly put. You got Tom Cruise stepping into the role of ex-military cop Jack Reacher in this adaptation of One Shot, which is a book that sits sort of halfway through the franchise, as far as I can understand. He's called in at the start of this film after an ex-army sniper, James Barr, has seemingly randomly opened fire on a bunch of civilians, and the police rather quickly form what looks to be an airtight open and shut case, the only wrinkle being the suspect's refusal to explain himself in the slightest. Instead, he only requests that they get Jack Reacher, which comes as a surprise to Reacher, who knows this guy only as someone who escaped justice for murdering a group of private military contractors in Iraq. After it turns out the victims had been raping local women, the incident was hushed up and Barr was cut loose, much to Reacher's distaste. He shows up more to laugh in Barr's face than to help him, but before he can get there, an attempt's made on Barr's life that leaves him in a coma. After a bit of needling by Barr's lawyer, played by Elton Musley Pike.
I saw his lawyer.
His lawyer, hey. Jack Reacher takes a look at the case and finds that things are not what they seem.
The dame was loaded.
Quickly uncovering indications of the involvement of more than just Barr in the shooting, and that the targets may not have been quite as arbitrary as first thought. Before long, he and Helen are neck deep in a dangerous, mysterious conspiracy. So mysterious that by the end of it, I'm still not completely clear on what the goal was. Something to do with buying up property on the cheap, I think? This plan is hatched by the mysterious Mr. The Zek, played by Werner Herzog, who has a fine line in the mysterious, grizzled stories about his incarceration in a Russian gulag, but very little in the way of actual motive for his actions. Now, Jack Reacher seemed to have all of its film success ducks in a potential film success row heading up to its release earlier this year, so it's a little surprising that while it's not exactly flopped, I'm sure much better things were expected of it than it actually went on to do. Tom Cruise is still probably the film industry's most bankable star. It's from a successful and well-liked series of novels. What could go wrong? I would contend not much did go wrong, but it's hard to look at Jack Reacher and think that anything went particularly right either. It's never less than competent in anything that it does, but it's hardly excelling at anything either.
Yeah, it feels like it was sort of less than some of its parts, I feel.
Yeah, what confused me I think the most is it's a book that was written in 2005, which is a shame for me because I was hoping it was written in the early 80s, maybe early 90s at a push, because that's around at what age this film seems to have been made. It feels dated, and I can only attribute this to its relative directness in storytelling, which I'd normally be on board with, this kind of behaviour, but here it comes across as rather procedural and flat. There's not much flair to it, which, given the work that Christopher McQuarrie's been involved with over the course of his career, seems a little bit strange, which is, as I say, not to say that Jack Reacher's necessarily doing much wrong. Cruise is believable in his role as essentially a Chandler-esque hard-edged private eye. The talented supporting cast do what's asked of them, and the narrative is reasonably strong. My only real niggle is the motivation behind the villains, but I suppose that comes down to a lesson of McQuarrie's previous Way of the Gun, that in sufficient quantity, money is motive with a universal adapter. Probably projecting an unfair double standard over Jack Reacher. After all, if this had appeared with a less storied cast and crew behind it, I'd probably be enthusing about a solid old-school thriller slash whodunit with the occasional great action scene, because that's really what Jack Reacher delivers. May well be unfair to expect more, but I never did claim it to be fair.
Yeah, I think, Scott, that I liked it a bit more than you. I thought it was a decent thriller. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
My brain kept intruding at some points and going, why are they doing that? Mm. And I was trying to, just shut up and just enjoy it. And the identity of the villain, or one of two potential identities, you know pretty much right away. Mm. That may just be cynicism or just having seen so many similar types of film. But even that aside, yeah, it's enjoyable. I get what you're saying, though. I think if it didn't have Richard Jenkins and David Oyelowo and particularly Tom Cruise in it, with people like that, you feel it should be special as opposed to simply good.
Yeah.
Which maybe is a bit unfair. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think it was the biggest budget film in the world, and it wasn't one of Tom Cruise's bigger pages. Well, I may be entirely wrong about that. It's a decent thriller that you can certainly sit down of an evening and enjoy.
It's very solid. It's amazingly competent, and it's actually quite good. It feels like everything's set up for it to be really good, and it's just that kind of level below it that makes you... It kind of freaks you out a little bit. And if it had been any other confluence of people and actions going into it, you know, I would have enjoyed this probably... I probably wouldn't have had that expectation at the front end, and I would have enjoyed it more at the back end.
It's on the watch list for Kate and I, and I have to say that the trailer made it feel like it was actually... This was going to have some quite smart dialogue and some sort of nifty little scenes, you know, the scene where he confronts the four or five guys outside, you know, before the fight, you chose this, that kind of scene. And the scene with him on the bus, where he gets out the car and, you know, they're chasing the car and he gets out and lets the car roll down the street and the guy hands him his hat.
That's a nice scene, actually.
Little bits like that. It hinted at sort of really nice little touches on the side, and the trailer seemed to concentrate a lot on those, and I thought this is a film which looks like it has quite a bit going for it, actually, but by the sounds of that's possibly perhaps no surprise, but have they picked the best bits for the trailer?
They've certainly picked the most marketable and obviously sort of catchy bits, I think, for it. I don't want to come with the wrong impression. I think everything that it does is really solid. It's a solid film to watch, and I think you would enjoy watching it, but it just has, like you say, it's picked the best bits and front-loaded them in your expectations, and it can't quite deliver on having more of those fellas backed up in it.
I hesitate to use the word competent when describing films, because it really feels like it's damned with faint praise when it shouldn't be, because so many films don't even achieve competence.
Yeah, I was going to say, these days competence is actually quite a high bar.
Yeah, it's a solid thriller. Again, it feels like it's missing a spark just to lift it that bit above it, in which you'd expect. But I mean,
it's how I felt about Trance. It's like, this is good, but it should be really good, and I'm not quite sure why it isn't. That kind of thing.
For some reason, the touch paper hasn't taken.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise, hate him or really hate him in real life.
Well, he's not tall enough for this role, so clearly you have to hate him.
He's much taller in Left Wing on the page. His general charismatic self, he's believable as a sort of smart and slightly mysterious Jack Reacher. You've got a supporting cast like the likes of Robert Duvall. It's conspired to not be as good as it should have been. That's all. It's entirely enjoyable otherwise. Just it's missing polish or a certain vital spark to lift it above its what it is.
Son of a gun. Ah, well.
He's a groovy son of a gun.
The Marvel X-Men bandwagon rolls on with yet another character spin-off film, and yet again it chooses to focus on fan-favourite and cinema cash cow Wolverine. X-Men Origins Wolverine, the previous such film, was widely regarded as a misfire despite some entertaining action. So can The Wolverine succeed where that movie fell short of the mark? Drew?
It can, although first let me say that in the cinema at least, X-Men Origins Wolverine, I actually really enjoyed. Although having visited again a couple of weeks ago before watching The Wolverine, I found it considerably less successful, particularly the finale. So
I enjoyed it the first time round, I have to say.
Yeah, apparently I enjoyed it 3 out of 5 in my review from back in the day, but I agree. It was basically a reasonably good film that was let down by an ending that just...
Good film that felt the need to introduce Ryan Reynolds.
Oh, to be fair, it is one of Ryan Reynolds' better performances, even without a beard, which is amazing. And it did have him living in that great People Are Dead Now line, which I really liked. So having said that, I did quite enjoy, at least first time round, X-Men Origins Wolverine. This one is a step above. It begins in Nagasaki in 1945, just as an atomic bomb is dropped from an airplane, and Wolverine saves the life of a Japanese soldier. Cut forward nearly 70 years, and the soldier that saved Wolverine's life is now the head of a huge Japanese corporation and has spent several years and an insane amount of money, as much of the world's adamantium as he can get his hands on, and trying to find Wolverine to pay him back for his debt. This offer to pay him back takes the form of taking Wolverine's amazing healing ability away from him and letting him die a natural death. Wolverine, while he's thinking this over, has the decision taken out of his hands and finds himself vulnerable and not healing, while people are still continuing to shoot at him. After this, there's a bit of inter-family fighting, machinations to take over a corporation, and Wolverine trying to protect a girl whose family are trying to kidnap her. You know, typical loving family that you see in films so often. I enjoyed this really quite a lot. There's some really good action sequences, even if the finale's a bit over the top and you see exactly where it's going. And it's quite interesting to see a sort of Superman-like character finally made vulnerable, although I don't feel that's played quite enough. Wolverine becomes, for a large chunk of the film, vulnerable to gunshots and he's bleeding, but never ever feel he's actually in danger of dying, which is a bit of a problem. I think if you felt the character was really struggling from not being able to heal and in real danger, that it'd been more successful. But once again, it's Hugh Jackman in a role he knows well and is always very entertaining and likeable in, playing an interesting character with a slightly different spin that we've seen so far.
I think Wolverine works certainly better than the last origin story and probably better than at least parts of most of the X-Men films. It does a really good job, like you say, of making a character that was slightly boring. I think Hugh Jackman kind of managed to pull it off with his charisma, but you have a character who's basically invulnerable. He could very well have fallen into the kind of sort of Superman trap of being
he's a god.
Yeah, he's too uninteresting. I mean, he's a guy that you can basically decapitate and he'll just grow a body back. By artificially kind of limiting that, it feels like there was a wide goal there that he could have shot some bullets through. But the problem with this is, when Wolverine gets shot, he's basically still doing the same shit that he normally does. It's just that after it, he goes, oh, I'm bleeding. I better lie down for a little while. And then he lies down for a little while, and then he's fine.
Because that's really interesting. You've got him finally vulnerable, and if he'd been unable to fight in the way he normally fought, but it seemed more just to, like, he looks down every so often, he goes, oh, that's ruined my shirt. That's a bit inconvenient. And then carries on fighting as normal. So it's a bit of a missed opportunity there. But the fact that it's there at all is still certainly interesting.
Certainly the rest of the story is acceptable. And the action is actually pretty good. One of the better action films seen this summer. I like that quite a lot. I see that director James Mangold was behind 3:10 of Yuma. And that's quite interesting because I think in parts of this, it does have something of a Western vibe. It's got a lot of, you know, a stranger walking into a foreign town and...
Yeah, and then hiding out in a wee town and trying to hide from the bad guys, and then the townsfolk coming around him and stuff and wanting some help.
Yeah, and of course it's going back to the whole Seven Samurai, you know, Ronin sort of stuff. It plays on that quite well. And all that works reasonably well. It's a strong background. The most interesting thing, of course, I think for me at least, is what is doing to Wolverine as a character. Him confronting his own past and his guilt over the killing of Jean Grey in X-Men 3. Such little things like that. And it manages to kind of make Wolverine a far more interesting character. And it'll be interesting to see what they do with him going forward, if they do have any more sort of in this time frame. They do make some reasonable changes to his character, which could have some interesting consequences going forward.
Consequences.
For the most part, it's a really solid action film. It's got better characters, certainly characterization, at least in terms of the main character. You could probably argue that the villains are sort of just there to drive the plot. I don't think they were brilliantly realised in the rest of it.
I don't think they're brilliantly realised, but at least the female villain is particularly unlikable, so that's something you can get behind. Even if she's fairly one note, it's like that character, just would you kill her already? It's that sort of feeling. So that's worthwhile. Some films don't quite manage that.
I mean, it works. It's a thoroughly enjoyable big budget action tentpole film, which has been somewhat weak this year, I'd probably argue.
Well,
certainly compared to other years. And this is one of the better ones. But I mean, really, that was it. There's not been too much else this summer that's blown me away. Wolverine, I think, is a pretty...
Did Iron Man 3 really blow you away?
I loved Iron Man 3.
Yeah, Iron Man 3 is fantastic.
I haven't watched it yet, so I'm not arguing otherwise.
We like it, I think, more than most people, I would imagine. Mm. But I really loved Iron Man 3. I thought there's a lot of really, really cool and interesting and really funny things with that character, so I liked it a lot.
Well,
Wolverine not taking quite so many risks with the character, but I think it does a really solid job of moving him along at the same time as delivering a really good action film.
I'm disappointed that at no point has Napoleon Dynamite appeared as Wolverine's nemesis.
That is somewhat left field. Care to explain further? Pitch me. Elevator pitch.
You clearly don't remember Napoleon Dynamite. Some people out there will get it, Scott. I don't feel the need to explain myself to you. I'm happy with who I am.
For some reason.
Ryan Gosling, Nicholas Winding Refn, beautiful cinematography, wafer-thin plot, Kristen Scott Thomas looking amazingly hot in Platinum Blonde and swearing like a trooper, violence. What can there possibly be that's not to like, Scott?
Well, I disagree with a couple of those things anyway.
I mean, it's like Drive, but with Kirsten Scott Thomas, but it isn't, because it's not any good at all. But that's a shame, isn't it? I mean, I...
more than you take the name of Gosling in vain!
Look, more than anyone else, I was signed up to the Church of Gosling established after Drive that you've set up so adequately. And I mean, I was on board with it, even when he was in sort of slightly shitty films like Gangster Squad. But I was sold on him, and I was so looking forward to Only God Forgives. I mean, I'd seen the trailer umpteen times. I thought, that looks quite stylish, and so on and so forth. I thought, that looks like quite a cool action scene. That looks like quite a cool character. But I was very hyped for this film. What it does is this film has taken everything that was good about Drive and then reduced it to its most base elements and then repeated it ad infinitum for 2 hours or whatever it is in this film, and it just fails. Okay, I'll back up a step. What you've got here is Ryan Gosling as Julian, which is not a great name for a character. He's a drug smuggler. He is in Bangkok, and he's sort of tied up in a syndicate with his brother and a few other people, and his mother's involved as well, and they're trying to get a hold of the cocaine, I think. Certainly the drug smuggling activities from Thailand back out to America. This takes something of a left turn when Julian's brother is killed.
Smoked.
After a not particularly likable sequence, we're treated to him after a kickboxing match. He's wandering around, basically trying to find an underage prostitute, which he can't do, and then he finds a prostitute, and then he kills her, and then a policeman shows up and finds the murdered girl's father, tells the father to kill Julian's brother, and then chops the hands off this father. Because why not? And this is more or less your introduction within the first, what, 30 minutes of the film. And it has a high degree of unlikability on everyone that's on screen at that time. And it just keeps going downwardly from there. There's not much of a rest of a plot to go by. Kirsten Scott Thomas is Julian's mother, who comes back and is trying to track down who killed Julian's brother. And she employs the usual group of lackeys that they've got to try and find this person. And then from there, track down the policeman that killed him. But the policeman, who I believe is Chang, played by Vithaya Pansringham or something along those lines, my apologies, but close enough, let's call him Vince. Vince, who takes no guff from anyone and is quite on board with chopping people's hands off with a large sword, because, well, apparently that's what the police do over in Thailand. Not ones for judges and juries. This is essentially Judge Dredd, but with a sword rather than a gun. And so it goes, with basically Chang taking no shit from this family of American ne'er-do-wells and defending himself within the utmost of his ability, which generally involves killing everyone, which is fine. But it's strange that the person who, honestly, I'm most morally aligned with is the policeman who's just arbitrarily killing people rather than bringing them to justice, which kind of speaks volumes about the morality of this film. Basically, it doesn't have any.
It's quite staunchly amoral.
Taking your morals and leaving them well aside, which I could maybe get behind. I mean, Drive, if you look at the central character of Drive, he's certainly not likable in the first instance, but he, at least what he's doing, even if it's unpleasant, is on
you,
the side.
You grow
of
to like him
people.
In Drive. He's gradually revealed to be human.
Yeah, whereas you do get none at all of that in anything in Only God Forgives, and it's really unpleasant to watch.
The big difference there, Scott, to Ryan Gosling is in Drive, Ryan Gosling has a character. In Only God Forgives, he doesn't. He has no character traits at all. He's just a person. It's not even one of his trademark low-key restrained performances like in Drive or Place Beyond the Pines. He's just a man who's on screen. He's only just there so his name can be in it. Yeah. He doesn't have a role. He doesn't have a card. He has nothing to do. He's just a person who inhabits some clothes.
And doesn't do that very well, to be honest. There's not really much like about him. There's not really much of a character to him. He doesn't do anything particularly interesting. Most of the interesting things happen to other people that he kind of wanders around and stumbles across later. Actually, the hero of it's the Thai detective, and he's not particularly likable.
Or at all.
It's a very difficult film to like or appreciate or to even understand roughly what the point of it was, because it doesn't seem to have any. I know Drive was, I think, unfairly criticised for being violent. It did a good job of implying violence, whereas this film actually is just unpleasantly violent.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's not just a thought about this. I'd probably need to watch it again to be absolutely sure. But this film just does seem gratuitously violent, whereas anything that would be levelled at that in Drive was really just more of an implication. You kind of filled it in your mind. This one makes no bones about actually just chopping hands off, this sort of thing, and it just doesn't do any emotional impact to it. It's just stuff happening for the sake of it. It's basically just a slasher film at that point. And there's no other artistry to it either. I would normally expect this to look stylish coming from Refn, but it just looks really ugly. What looked stylish in the trailers was stylish, but it was stylish when you consider it for like a fraction of a second. But what they've actually done in this film has been basically the first 10 to 15 minutes of this is almost entirely shot just under a red light, and it looks so ugly.
It's so oppressive too. Red lights here, it's ugly, it's got a bit oppressive too. It's just desperate for any section to sit shot in red lights to end.
I couldn't find anything to like in the film. I really wanted to. I went in very primed to think, this is, I'm going to give this every benefit of the doubt I can possibly give, because I loved all these trailers and I thought they looked super stylish. The general sort of gist of the plot sounds cool. It sounds like it's heartening back to, you know, Chow Yun-fat era, you know, John Woo, Hong Kong cinema sort of thing. This is going to be cool. This is going to be a combination of John Woo and your Tony Jaa fella. But it delivered nothing like that. It basically delivered unpleasant violence, unpleasant imagery, boring characters, and no point whatsoever.
The Church of Gosling casts you out!
It's a big disappointment. As Scott said, there aren't any interesting characters. Nobody's got any depth to them. It's quite anti-women. Women seem to exist just to fuck or kill. And the problem always with any film that focuses around criminals is making you want to care for them.
It's criminals are people too.
Generally they're people, but if you get a hook on somebody, say
Abu Hamza.
Even if somebody's just like a charismatic villain, that's fine. You can understand why they have power over people, or just like menacing.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get something like Goodfellas. You've got Henry Hill, who's seduced by the glamour of being a gangster because he's been around it since he was a kid, and you understand that, and then get into that world, and you can understand, have empathy for the people and interest in them. In this, it's just a bunch of bastards being bastardly to people, and then it ends. It's really
bastardly is a word, but I love it.
Muttley and bastardly.
A bunch of unpleasant people doing unpleasant things to other people and having unpleasant things done to them. It's not a film.
I was disappointed. This is normally the sort of thing I would defend, but I just can't. There's just nothing good in here.
Clearly you're wrong. 8 out of 10. Now, Edgar Wright's unofficial Three Colours Cornetto trilogy concludes with The World's End, in which Simon Pegg and several old school friends return decades later to a town where they previously failed to complete an epic pub crawl. Only this time, there are robots. Are there not, Drew?
There are, except don't call them robots.
Oh.
Apparently they're quite touchy about that.
Oh, shit.
But that's it. That's the entire plot.
Sorry, man.
After they left school, they went on the 12 pub crawl, which culminates at a pub called The World's End in the town where they all grew up. It having failed and a few of the members dropped out quite early on. 20 years pass. They've all moved on with their lives, apart from Simon Pegg's character, Gary King, who's still the party boy that he always was, and seeking some meaning in his life in a group therapy session of some kind. We don't find out quite what. He decides that he's going to get his friends back together. They're going to travel back to the town and complete it. That's the setup. That's what they do. They go back to town and, as you say, robots, although don't call them robots, have replaced a good number of the people in the town. And, well, that's it. There's just a lot of jokes and fighting
with
robots.
Are they friendly robots, Drew?
They would seem to be friendly robots, but you will perhaps be unsurprised to find out that if you don't agree with them, they become less friendly.
Is there any explanation as to why these people are robots, Drew?
There is, but I'll leave that for the watching of the film.
Oh, okay.
It's, I know we don't want to call them robots, but nothing has been suggested in the last 10 minutes that's better than smashy, smashy egg people.
Yes. There are a couple of classic lines in that really had me chortling. I'm struggling to wonder where to put this into the Cornetto trilogy. It's definitely not as successful as Hot Fuzz.
You're struggling to wonder?
Yes. That's a perfectly cromulent sentence.
It's a wonder struggle.
Yes, I'm struggling to think where to put this into the Cornetto trilogy. It's not as good as Hot Fuzz, not as successful, but it's possibly, in the end, funnier than Shaun of the Dead. Although it does take a while to get going, largely due to the fact that Simon Pegg's character is quite astonishingly unlikable.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a
dick
wanker, and he's a prat dick wanker, call him what you will.
Prat dick wanker seems to suffice.
Yes.
It covers a wide base.
Gary, prat dick wanker king, he is just such an unlikable character first. It takes quite a while to to warm to the film, and you don't ever really warm to him that much. But the superb supporting cast pick up all the slack. And it's not that Simon Pegg's performance is bad, it's just the character's so unlikably written that it struggles to come back from that. But by third to certainly halfway into the film, I was roaring with laughter. It's a fantastic film. If you like the other Cornetto trilogy films, you're going to enjoy this. Stick with it through the initial hump to get into the film, and it's a hoot.
Is what it is.
I agree with most of that. I think I'd need to watch it a few more times to see where it finally comes in, but I do love Hot Fuzz enough that I can't possibly see it being better than that. However,
no.
I think this is actually better than I thought coming out of it, because there's a few things, like as you say, like the Gary King character is so unlikable, but is that the reasons behind his unlikability that sort of eventually makes the film in the end, to the point that I kind of see in retrospect why it was necessary, but for that first... Half an hour, maybe.
It's a hard bump to get over that.
The timing of it, for at least for me, was to absolute perfection, because about 20 seconds after the point where I thought, you know what, I just don't like this character so much, I'm not going to care about the rest of it, it suddenly shifted gears, and it was the sort of first offing of the smashy, smashy egg person.
Yes. The fight in the bathroom.
Yeah, and from that moment on, it just kept piling comedy after comedy after action after comedy and so on after that. It kind of really built to a really good crescendo. So I think the pacing of it might actually be masterful, but I'd probably need to watch it another couple of times before I sort of fully commit to that opinion.
Yeah, I really do think it does help, actually, and obviously we didn't, but to help to know that it is just worth sticking with. It does pay off in the end, and I was roaring by the end of it. And have the great suggestion for a band name, if you ever create one, of Bermuda Rhombus and the Aquanazis.
No, there's some really brilliant drunken lines that come out of this. Again, I'm not sure how well this plays outside of Britain, but for all of us inside Britain, I think you would love this film. It's very funny. As everything that was good about the last couple of films, certainly one of the funniest films I've seen this year. I don't know if it's better than the other World's End film that we...
This is the end, I think, probably not, because it was funny basically from the beginning, and this one had a learning curve to it.
Well worth a look. Definitely give it a bash.
I just would love to see Nick Frost get something of his own to do.
Yeah.
Rather than sort of us being like Simon Pegg signs up to the film and says, well, you let my mate be in it as well, when he's clearly really funny on his own. I just wish he'd get a chance to do something more.
For now, I think that just about wraps it up, does it not, boys?
Certainly does.
What is doge?
I think it was an honorific back in Napoleon times.
But of course. I was Craig, as always. Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
Drew was Drew.
Goodbye.
That's two in a row, man. Yeah, so catch you on the flip side.
You're twisting my melon, man.
Oh, you know, you talk so cheap, you're twisting my melon. Bye!
I feel on a high, cause the next film on the agenda is clearly a masterpiece.
That's not accurate.